I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The world changes at such a fast pace, sometimes it's hard to put your finger on what exactly is it we're doing right now. Michael Malone has taken that one step further in his new book, The Future Arrived Yesterday. Michael will tell us about the virtualization of the workplace and what corporations may look like in the future. And as the workplace becomes more virtual, our shopping habits have followed. But this may not be the future of retail. We'll talk with Larry Weeks and Daniel Eisenman from the design firm ComArts, who join us to explain the future of retail from their perspective and what they think your neighborhood mall may look like. All this plus the latest news from PlanEtizen and our City Views commentator Walker Smith coming up on today's Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Michael Malone is an author, entrepreneur, and journalist who has written extensively about the places where business and technology intersect. His work, The Virtual Corporation, predicted the way many companies are organized today. Now he's returned with a new book about the structure of the corporation called The Future Arrived Yesterday. 20 years ago, you pioneered the concept of the virtual corporation. Now you say our organizational concepts must evolve again to meet the very fast pace of change. Explain what you mean.
Well, several factors are at work that led me to decide that the model of the virtual corporation was becoming increasingly obsolete. One of them is just the passage of time. A generation goes by, and we tend to rethink the way we operate together in the course of a single generation. There's also the technological imperative. We have Moore's Law and Metcalfe's Law of Networks firing away, doubling capacity of computers every couple years, increasing the value of networks. That just keeps moving forward and accelerating the pace of life. And so oftentimes the solutions at one point in time, which seem very cutting edge and almost science fiction, become obsolete and old hat after a decade or two. And then the third reason was, over the course of the year since writing The Virtual Corporation, I began to recognize that there were some fundamental flaws in that model. And that came from being a business reporter all these years and covering companies and the way they behave, but also in my own life.
Well, you've raised two questions for me. One, you say the need to evolve our organizational concepts result in part from the need to rethink the way we work together every generation. Tell me more. What does that mean? Why does generational change cause us to rethink the way we work together?
It's a matter of our relationship with the technology that surrounds us. You look at the kids graduating from college this year, and they were born the year the Macintosh was announced. As a result, they've lived in a world in which there's never not been a glowing computer screen nearby. They've spent their entire conscious lives from the first day of school on the internet. They've pioneered social networks. They are the children of Web 2.0. As a result, they see the world differently, just as we did. When we were coming out of the 1980s into the early 1990s, it was obvious to me and even to my co-author, the venture capitalist Bill Davidow, who was a generation older than me, that technology was transforming the way that we dealt with each other. We were communicating faster. We were able to create products that were much more customized for the individual. We were able to do all sorts of things we had never done before. And yet organizations were still stuck in the 1935 divisional Sloan General Motors model. So we began to ask ourselves, if you were to follow the trajectory of technology and what it would enable individuals to do, what kind of organization would arise from that? And that was the virtual corporation. And that fit with our growing notion that we didn't want to work in the same job for 25 years. We never expected to get the gold watch. We wanted to take our bag of skills and be able to move around freely and find different kinds of jobs and change our careers and become more entrepreneurial with our lives. Well, fast forward now 15, 20 years, this new generation sees the world very differently than we did. I look at my 18-year-old, and I can see him in the evening sitting there at his gamer computer, and he's simultaneously IMing, sending Gmails. He's downloading iTunes. He's learning guitar tabs with a Fender Stratocaster in his lap. He's visiting his Facebook page every couple minutes. He's surfing the web, and he's doing homework at the same time. These kids operate in a different reality. Theirs is much more of a phenomenological field in which everything's going on simultaneously and things of value sort of rise up out of this ocean of activity. While we older folks tend to see things much more linearly, sequentially, and discreetly, I don't think the current generation of new college grads ever intends to really have what we think of as a job. They'll have a career. They'll have a wide range of experiences. But what they're really going to have in their minds is a new startup. They're going to have a .com called themselves, in which they take on work as needed. They sell their skills. They move rapidly about. And this conforms with the technology that's emerging. I mean, we look out there at companies like Google, for example, developing these IT clouds, massive complexes of interconnected individual computers that create a cloud of computing, a cloud of capability that can be reformatted and reused in different applications. I think kids, young people now see themselves the same way. So given all that, even the virtual corporation, which was essentially a supercharged, highly networked corporate model that was relatively edgeless, now begins to look a bit passé, and that we need something altogether new.
You've made a good case for why we need to evolve to something else. What does that something else look like? What you have a name for it. You have characteristics of it.
Yes. It's interesting. When we first came up with the title, The Virtual Corporation, I remember my book agent, the publisher, everybody wanting Bill and I to change the name because nobody understood what virtual meant. And
those were the days.
Those were the days. And so, interestingly, I came up with the idea for this new model for organizations about the time the dot-com bubble burst. I was running I guess it was the world's largest technology business magazine. It was Forbes ASAP, and it had about 1 million readers. And like most other magazines of that ilk, it exploded and disappeared when the dot-com bubble burst. So I had a little bit of time to sit around and think. And I was typing up, as many people were doing at the time, as many people are doing right now, I was typing up my resume. And it suddenly struck me that I had worked for a couple dozen companies in my career, like most people in Silicon Valley, and yet almost all of them were gone. Almost every company I'd ever worked for, big ones, small ones, had all died. And I thought about, you know, when you're a kid and you're sitting on your grandfather's lap and you say, gee, Grandpa, what did you do 30, 40, 50 years ago, back to 500 years ago? Grandpa would say, well, you know, I worked at the Ford Motors River Rouge plant bolting left front quarter panels onto Ford Escorts. Or I spent 23 years at some corporation. You had jobs. You defined yourself with that. And as I looked at my resume and I thought, well, when my grandkids sit on my lap and ask me what I did, what am I going to say? Well, I worked at a whole bunch of companies that are dead and you've never heard of. And then it struck me, it was almost an epiphany, that a truly virtualized economy, which is what we all seem to be heading for, was seriously lacking in a human dimension. There was an element missing there, and that's the element of belonging. That as human beings, we want to belong to something. We want to be part of a crusade that's bigger than ourselves. And one of those things is our job. And so it struck me that we had this very disturbing, a growing contradiction. And that was the world was becoming increasingly virtualized. We were blowing up all of our organizations. We were sending information around the globe. All the centers of power were being distributed now throughout the planet in this vast global internet-based market. Everything was coming apart, and companies, in order to survive this, were having to become more and more adaptable, more and more ever-changing, and more protean. They had to become shapeshifters. And yet at the same time, there was an increasing personal human need to be part of something stable and enduring, something that we could tie ourselves to. And so it was an effort to try to resolve that apparent contradiction, which struck me as a very dangerous future for us if we didn't resolve it, that got me thinking about what that organization would look like. And I called it the Protean Corporation. And that's what I wanted to name the book. And once again, I ran into editors and publishers saying, oh, no one's going to understand what Protean means. And so that's why it's called The Future Arrived Yesterday.
Well, I might agree with the editors on that score. But let's talk about this. I want to, you know, Michael, that our show is named Smart City, and that we're always trying to understand the point of view of our guest, but to try to apply that point of view to the larger community. And in your case, it's very interesting because I've had colleagues who believe that because we are in just the situation you describe, that we have careers but not jobs, but we are not particularly loyal to organizations any longer, that our loyalties will lie more with a cause or with a community, and that young people, because of that loyalty to community, not organization, it's driving young people to choose communities where they believe they can build a life and that they will have multiple job opportunities or career opportunities and that they can be satisfied in that community. What's your reaction to that? In other words, did you think about solving the belonging issue outside the company, if you will, or the Protean organization?
Yeah, I did. In fact, you're going into my next book, which is going to come out at the end of the year. I wrote with Tom Hayes, and that's called No Size Fits All. Let me give you my reasoning on all this, and then you can see where the holes are. First of all, we have the contradiction of wanting permanence plus infinite flexibility and adaptability. And I was also struck that in any population of people, the 80-20 rule works. Maybe most of us want to have an exciting career where everything's changing and endless challenges, but some small fraction of people want that traditional stability. Those people tend to be the ones who maintain society. They're the ones that keep civilization going. Inside of an organization, they're the cultural memory. They're the ones that say, this is where we keep this information. This is how you fill out this form. Those people are getting jettisoned in the modern world, and that's an enormous loss because once you lose them, there's no there. There's no center in any organization. So the first thing I said was, okay, let's build something permanent and solid. That's the solid core of the organization. And you give these people almost infinite job security. If they're in a nonprofit, you give them a permanent position. I mean, they're the last – if the organization shuts down, they're the last people to turn off the lights. They have power over even the CEO or the chairman. Everything else then is flexible. It's a cloud. It's a cloud of talent. And the company or the organization gets really big or really small as needed. So that's the Protean organization. It looks like the model of the atom, a solid core surrounded by this cloud of probability that gets used in many different ways. Well, then from there, with Tom Hayes, we began to look at what does the world market look like? And we have this notion in our minds that what the world looks like in the future, the world economy, is this one vast global internet-based marketplace. And it's going to triple in size because we have 1 billion people using it now, and the next 10 years or so, we're going to add 2 billion more from the developing world. And this seems to be the future we're heading towards. Well, I don't agree with that. I think that's half of the story, but I think the future actually is bipolar between this monolithic global market and then a millions of small, interconnected, internally homogeneous communities, micro communities, taking the Facebook and the MySpace and the Twitter and the LinkedIn model to the next step, that we're all going to belong to 20 or 30 of these very small communities. And why do I think that's going to happen? And this is where we get back to the city. My sense is that the history of the digital revolution, the history of electronics in the last 50 years has been one long attempt to restore what we lost with the Industrial Revolution in the 1790s. We all began in small communities. We were in villages where we knew everybody there, and We dealt with them on a daily basis, so we knew their personal life and their professional life. Or we lived in cities, and in the cities themselves were small neighborhoods where you knew the butcher at the corner, and you knew the guy who ran the cleaners, and you knew the guy who ran the delicatessen, and you knew your neighbors. And inside that wonderfully little coherent community, you could anticipate how people would behave. You had common causes. You not only bought and sold services and products, but you bartered them. And these things had their own internal culture. I think that's what the world looks like in the future. A vast global market that's just going to be insane. It's going to be chaos. It's going to be American Idol with 3 billion people. And then at the other end, it's going to be 10 million of these small, internet-enabled, because it won't necessarily be people next door to you, but it'll be people who share common interests with you, whether it's mice in China or it's 65 Pontiac GTOs, or if it's the problem about getting a crosswalk put in by your local school or zoning or whatever it is. But you're going to gather in these groups, and you know they're not going to be more than there won't be more than 140 people, because that is the natural human group. They've discovered, the military discovered that, sociologists have discovered that. So these groups can be about 100 people, and you're going to know everybody in that, and you're going to have very common interests, and there's going to be rules of getting in. It'll be hard to get in at a certain point. You'll create your own little markets with each other. And we're going back to the neighborhood. It's just that we will now combine our physical neighborhood with a multitude of these other virtual neighborhoods.
Well, we have to stay on this topic because it's too interesting not to, even though it's the next book. But just bear with me 1 minute.
Sure.
Indulge me. If you were a mayor, a community foundation president, someone who, you know, with some resources to do something in a local community, a mid-sized city, let's say, how would you think about these micro communities and putting them to work on behalf of your city and to strengthen your city?
I think all organizations, and that includes cities, have some very distinct new roles, and they're very different from what we think those jobs are now. Cities think that they're in charge of highways and sewage and the fire department, and all those things are still true, but they have some new roles. One of them is they're an aggregator. That is to say, their job is to find, instead of generating information and content, that information and content is being generated by thousands of people in a city. People are writing blogs. They're writing comments on web pages. They're doing vlogs. They're doing YouTube videos. They're doing all sorts of stuff. Millions and millions of words and pixels are being generated every month in an average city that the city has no contact with. And yet that is now the life of the city. It's no longer centralized. It's coming from the individuals. So one of the city's jobs is to find all that stuff, put it together, filter it, aggregate it, and create a place where people can go to find it all. And then second step, once you're the aggregator, you're now also the host, in the sense that you need to provide your citizens with the venues and the tools for them to build their own little communities inside of your community. That's how you manage your population now, is if you're the tool provider and you offer the venue, then you still have some element of control in a world in which control is being lost rapidly. I live in Sunnyvale, California. I'm right in the dead center, ground zero of Silicon Valley. And I go to the website. Yeah, it's nice. It's dynamic to a degree. It has a calendar, but it's not what you see on the great aggregator blog sites like Huffington Post or Pajamas Media or places like that, where stuff's going on all the time. That's where cities need to go. And then I think the third and most important thing they need to be, and this is once again fulfilling that growing human need, they need to be home. A lot of people in the world now, especially in the developed world, are losing their moorings. They're losing their tethering to their local community. They live there, but they spend their emotional lives somewhere else, on the web, telecommuting, sitting in telepresence work group meetings at the office. Their bodies are there, but their heads aren't. And cities are going to lose people. They've lost them now in a philosophical way by enabling them to to go other places easily. They need to create that home where you feel like you live in that city and you're on that website and you know the emotions and the dynamics of the city in real time. And that comes from providing all that information and providing that venue that makes people feel like they belong.
One more question. You have a short section at the end of your book, The Future Arrived Yesterday, the book that's in the bookstores now. It's titled Wildcatting as a Way of Life. Is that what we have to look forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. Once again, this is that technological imperative. Companies are going to have to be, and other entities, organizations, governments, nonprofits, they're going to have to be able to turn on a dime and become very different according to the needs of the marketplace out there, according to the needs of the world. As a result, companies are not going to be able to hang on to 10,000, 50,000, 150,000 employees in the traditional way. They're going to wax and wane, as will all other entities. As a result, most of us are going to find ourselves out in that cloud. We're going to be gypsies moving around cyberspace selling our skills. And companies and other organizations are going to devise new systems for hiring us, training us, and paying us, literally in a matter of minutes. I mean, it's very possible that our future out there, my future as a journalist might be to write one paragraph. And I get paid for that. Maybe it takes me 30 seconds and I get paid $50 for writing that paragraph. Or I might be brought into for 10 years. Everything now is on the table. Everything is going to be ever-changing. That makes us all essentially entrepreneurs. We are our own startups, and we're going to have to manage them, and we're going to have to be able to move fast, and we're going to have to be able to adapt. And smart cities, smart governments are going to find ways to empower us to do that. That means getting us the right technology, you know, staying abreast of wherever the state of the art is and broadband and everything else. It's going to be coming up with new ways to insure us, medical insurance, all kinds of other insurance. It's going to be creating places for us to go because we're going to be desperately in need to see other human beings. All those things. I mean, this is what cities of the future should be racing towards right now, because it's going to be a world full of self-employed wildcatters.
You've written a really important book, just as you did 20 years ago when you wrote The Virtual Corporation. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you. It was fun.
Michael Malone is the author of The Future Arrived Yesterday, The Rise of the Protean Corporation and What It Means for You. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
The floodgates are open. Well, at least that's what transit advocates would like to think. The federal government has just begun accepting applications for funding from the economic stimulus package to go towards passenger rail programs. The Wall Street Journal reports that billions of dollars were requested by states when the application period began on Monday. Some states, like California, didn't hold back. The Golden State submitted 42 applications for funding, adding up to $1.1 billion. The Washington, D.C. region also had its hand out, requesting more than $434 million. Analysts predict that the states that have already dedicated their own funding to rail projects will be more likely to receive additional funds to the stimulus program. Federal Railroad Administration officials say these grants will be awarded in late September or early October. Meanwhile, in other federal news, the Department of Housing and Urban Development is updating its rules about how loans to first-time homebuyers can be used, and some developers say the regulations are going to make it harder to build affordable housing. One new rule in particular would affect condominium loans insured by the Federal Housing Administration that allow people to put only 3.5% as a down payment, as opposed to the typical 20%. The proposed change would limit how many of those federally insured loans could be used to purchase units in new condo buildings. HUD officials admit that the new regulations are meant to protect HUD from the risks of the current mortgage crisis. A recent article from the San Diego Business Journal airs the concerns of local housing developers who say the proposed changes would not only limit their ability to build affordably priced units, but would also hurt low-income people looking to become first-time homebuyers. Others argue that maybe lower-income people shouldn't be trying to buy homes in the first place, especially in an unstable economic climate. Though real estate developers are calling for the rule change to be loosened, it appears to be moving ahead unchanged and set to take effect October 1st. And finally, a recent box office hit has some slum dwellers hoping for a chance to improve their living conditions. The Soweto slum in Johannesburg, South Africa, was the set of the recently released science fiction movie District 9. The film used the real-life shack dwellings of the slum as the fictional neighborhood where aliens are quarantined and face discrimination. But for residents of the actual slum, the fiction is not too far from the truth. According to a recent article from the Globe and Mail, Soweto residents are hoping that the global exposure will spur the government to bring about some improvements to the impoverished settlement. And while they welcome the spotlight on their settlement, they hope the embarrassment it brings to officials will inspire action. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, Larry Weeks and Daniel Eisenman from the design firm Communication Arts will tell us how the future of retail looks a lot like your local farmer's market. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The declining economy has led to a glut of retail space all around the country. So what will become of all that valuable real estate? Recently, the International Council on Shopping Centers held a competition to envision the shopping experience of the future. My guest today submitted a really interesting proposal called Crossroads City, and my guest Larry Weeks and Daniel Eisenman saw their contribution to the competition as an antidote to the amount of time consumers are spending online. As consumers slow their spending dramatically, big retailers are in trouble. That means large format retail buildings, malls, and shopping centers are in trouble. Describe the extent of the problem.
Well, the problem is extensive. I'll tell you this. Last year alone, 2008, on the order of 33,000 bricks and mortar retail stores closed. And this year, it's predicted that something on the order of 73,000 bricks and mortar stores are going to close. I can also tell you this. High-end predictions for number of shopping centers to close as a result of this recession, the high-end predictions on the order of 50% of shopping centers may close. Of course, there are much more conservative estimates than that, but that's the shocking one.
That is shocking and stunning, and so, you know, that's going to leave us with a lot of empty space, and I know you've been thinking about how to reuse that space, but let's back up a minute. Daniel, what are the forces that are going to shape the retail industry over the next decade?
Well, we see three major forces. One is the technological force, the second one is the ecological force, and the third one is cultural forces. Technological, we mean the internet, how internet is growing. Internet sales are growing in the order of 7% of all the retail sales, which means around $250 billion a year and growing steadily. On ecological forces, we see the shift toward a local, away from the monoculture. We see a trend to ecological and personal sustainability. We see people more interested in how the stores act and how they go about their business. We're going to see a trend in production, consumption, and reuse of items. And we also have cultural. Right now, we're experiencing some serious shifts in a culture environment. People are looking for FaceTime. They're looking for actual experiences where they can get their hands on and feel and touch and experience the products. I think we're also going to see an incredible mix of uses, new uses that, as you were mentioning, that I guess we're going to touch a little later. One of the last ones and one of the strongest ones is the blurring of the gender roles.
How does blurring of the gender roles affect retail?
Historically, somewhere on the order of 80% of consumer purchases are influenced by women. And we've all heard stories about the difficulty that men have interacting with a shopping center environment. But, you know, all those trends are starting to give way now. Things we're noticing, for example, in 1985, 30% of men's clothing purchases, clothes for men, were made by men. The other 70% were made by women. In 2005, 20 years later, 70% of men's clothing purchases were made by men and only 30% by women. So what we're seeing is a shift where men are taking more responsibility for shopping for apparel. And we see things like right now, grocery store, incidents of shopping in grocery stores is starting to equalize. That used to be something that women did much more of than men, but that's changing now. It's interesting when it used to be that males would marry very early after high school or college, have children right away, and they were less conscious of their appearance and consumer purchase decisions. They were focused on other things. Well, now men are staying single longer, and they're much more aware than they used to be of their own appearance. I mean, even if you look at men's magazines and the contents of those, how that shifted over the years, they're very fashion conscious now.
Even a football commercial, you can see even Nivea starting to appear in a football commercial for lotions and men's health products. So
yeah, that industry, the sort of health, beauty, and wellness industry, as baby boomers of both genders age, they're obviously becoming more aware of their appearance and mortality, and their goal of staying young becomes more apparent. And so the men are shopping that industry more as well. And on the flip side, women. I mean, it used to be that the sort of video game, video entertainment retail industry was something that catered more to men. But what we're seeing now is an equalizing of purchases between women and men in that industry. So that line is becoming blurred. So the great thing about all of this is not just where the purchases will lie, but something that underlies all of these concerns. And that is that for the conventional retail platform, meaning shopping in the physical world, to be relevant and continue into the future, it needs to exist and be successful on a social level before anything else. I mean, that's the real reason that people go shopping as opposed to buying. You know, buying is a strictly rational act. It's an act of hunting. It's a premeditated thing. But shopping is something that you do. It's emotional. It's something you do with friends. It's something that people crave. It's a sport. And the advantage that conventional retail has over the internet is the ability to go there and participate in that kind of emotional experience. And so shopping needs to succeed on that level.
You know, I wondered actually, with FaceTime being one of the trends that you cite, people craving FaceTime, I think obviously shopping has become recreation. It has become a way to spend time with friends. But if that high-end projection of retail shopping center closures came to pass, I mean, that's 50% reduction in places that we can go and have FaceTime. What will take its place?
Well, Carol, let me say this first of all, and that is we're in no danger at the moment of having too few places to shop and to recreate. In fact, right now, it could be argued that we're over-retailed from a shopping center standpoint. In terms of retail per capita, we have 6 times the amount here in America than exists in Europe. So if there is an attrition as a result of softness in the market and in demand, then that may be a correction that is okay. I don't think that our country, given its appetite for retail and the fact that it's one of the signatures of our lifestyle in America, is going to stand for being underserved in the retail market. So I don't think we're in that danger. We're seeing that people are craving more FaceTime. I mean, one thing that's very interesting in our local paper here in Boulder, even just a couple of days ago, we were talking about an article that we saw, and it was talking about eHarmony, I believe, and eCupid.com. And it was talking about how at eHarmony.com, I think membership rates were, and this is a computer dating company, memberships were up 20%, and at eCupid.com, they were up 50%. And the reason that they gave in the article was that in times of difficulty, in times of peril or challenge, people reach out more. They look more for social connections. And that, you know, that's the case. We've noticed that in difficult times, visitation of sporting events, movies, cultural events, all these things that bring people together, they move upward. Even in the Great Depression, movies was a pretty strong industry. And right now, I think the movie industry is up nearly 2.5% over last year, which certainly defies most trends.
Well, it does. Let's get into this, because what you've done is just described a set of trends you think are moving the retail industry to do something different, to provide a different response. You've imagined what that response will be. The International Council of Shopping Centers staged a competition. They ask entrants to imagine the shopping mall of the future, and your entry was widely praised by the judges. You call your concept Crossroads City, and tell me about it.
Crossroads City is a sort of model that we identified in ComArts. As we started to think about the future of retail and how things were unfolding and the difficulties in the industry, we wanted to think down the road. We wanted to run a model of the forces, try and predict the forces. When we identified a number of 10 forces, the 10 the prevailing forces that would act on and change retail in the next 10, 20, 30, and 50 years. We wanted to see how that would change the existing shopping center. So we identified a kind of hypothetical place. We called it Crossroads Mall. Crossroads is a name you encounter a lot in the retail industry. Hypothetical place. We wanted to identify the forces and kind of run the model of those forces acting on that mall at those different time frames. And so that's what we did. Now, coincidental to that, ICSC announced an international competition that was basically studying the same thing. They asked what retail would look like 50 years out. And so we started to address that. That was one real kind of difference in our approach. And it's really something that characterizes our approach in general in the professional right. world. And that is, instead of thinking of architecture or places as inert nouns, we tend to come at them from the place of experience and the sort of overlaying of all the ideas, whether they're architectural or industrial design or music or experiential. We have a very broad-based practice. And so we could kind of bring that salon of different points of view to bear on this issue. And the graphic novel kind of storyboard format lends itself nicely to something that has a foot in fiction and a foot in nonfiction. It allows you to exaggerate without appearing to deceive.
Right. And at the end, it's all about people at the end. If there's no people, there's no sales. If there's no sales, there's no shopping center. So if you think what a person wants and needs, it tends to create a much more successful project.
How does Crossroads City differ from Crossroads Mall that exists everywhere in America?
One of the most important factors or forces that will be happening here is the mix of uses. Right now, a Crossroads Mall is just entirely dedicated to shopping and some food court uses. But other than that, there's not much going on. So all the risk these malls are taking is coming from retail. And once retail is down, then the mall is down. So in order to spread the risk, this new uses are going to come in place. So
this is something that we're seeing in projects all over the world right now.
Right.
Is developers are wise enough now to diversify. Of course, we've extended this to its kind of logical stream in our Crossroads Mall model since we took it pretty far into the future. But what you're seeing in these places, you know what it's like. It's like the sort of hubs used to be in ancient cities all the way up to today. And that is the kind of most vital areas, the ones that can compete and succeed on a global level, are the ones that incorporate not just commercial uses. I mean, think about the Agora in Greece or the Renaissance Piazza all the way up to our town of Boulder today. They have commercial uses. You walk through and you hear the sounds and you smell the smells of the market and the bartering going on. But there's also the kind of social uses there. This is a place where there are the operas on the piazza. You have the great museums and the galleries in these areas. But also it goes into scientific and educational uses. You'll see in shopping centers in the future, you'll see more education, more schools, more museums. Cultural and artistic uses as well will start to engage. So you'll get a broad bandwidth of uses, and you'll get the kind of energy and social opportunities that come from that. In addition to that, you're going to get a broad mix of users, so that as we plug in retirement villages, places for people to grow older as a part of these malls, and residential components, and schools and nurseries, you're going to get children, you're going to get the elderly, you're going to get everyone in between, and you're going to get a much more broad bandwidth of people and experiences in these places.
Also, we got to remember that most of these shopping centers are located along main arteries in cities or along main roads, so there's a great opportunity to turn these places into transit-oriented facilities or developments where trains or suburban rails or bus stations could come in and become much more alive because of the traffic they're receiving.
Well, what you've described is certainly different from today's mall. It's not terribly different from a real city.
That's true. And I think the things that we were talking about right now, I mean, it's as Daniel outlined earlier, we've identified 10 forces, and they fall under several headings. Many of these headings are kind of the sort of social forces. These social needs and desires haven't changed ever. I mean, they're the same drivers that we've always felt. And we believe that once you realize and accept the fact that retail and shopping centers will thrive and persist and grow as a result of their ability to succeed on a social level, once you realize that that is the kind of basis for their success, then a lot of the kind of old sociological drivers kick back into this, and you'll see all of those becoming involved to fortify the existing shopping center. So from that standpoint, you're right. These aren't new ideas. These are ideas that we've seen in different ways throughout history. Now, things that are changing as a result of current trends are things that are driven more by technology. things that you see are responses or lessons that we've learned already from the short lifespan of internet shopping. And we can talk about those if you'd like.
There's two major aspects about internet shopping. There's the social networking aspect. People are spending a lot more time on Facebook, surrendering their information. They feel a lot more comfortable surrendering.
They're exchanging.
They're exchanging it.
They're exchanging it for heightened levels of service.
Right. So the question is, how do we bring the internet into bricks and mortars? What is that connection? How are retailers going to make that connection into to bring all those people in?
More and more, I mean, retailers will communicate on, they'll exist on many platforms. They're going to, you know, they're going to exist online and in bricks and mortar situations. We're working on an interesting project in New York, and they, you know, they've come to the realization that as opposed to online retail, when a person walks into a physical retail space, what the retailer is aware of is this. They know that a pair of legs walked in the door, then they don't know much. Then they know whether the pair of legs bought something and left, or didn't buy anything and left. And that's pretty much the extent of the relationship they have with the customer. Now, you compare that to any number of online entities, and they know every movement that you made, everything that you looked at, the sort of chain of events that led to your purchase. They can group that with other people who had similar chains of events. Then they can help serve you better, with your permission, by suggesting things that were purchased by people who have made similar purchases to you. It's the whole kind of wiki mentality, where it gets smarter about you, learns how to serve you better the more that you interact with it, so that your participation helps its intelligence. It's open source as opposed to closed. And with RFID technologies and the ability now to track products throughout their lifespan, we're going to open up a whole new world in the conventional retail environment for that sort of data gathering, profile building, and enhanced customer service to occur.
Plus, better inventories, more controlled merchandise, and all sorts of things that will help the economy to make retailers more efficient as well.
Let me ask a couple of quick questions. One of the trends that you identified, I think, was this notion of shopping local, buying local. Heretofore, local, you don't see much local in shopping malls, and one of the reasons is local hasn't been bankable. Do you think that's going to change?
Yes, we do think it's going to change. And I'll tell you that many surveys have been done on this subject, and the top three complaints that people have against shopping malls, the lack of anything new or interesting happening in shopping centers. The second top complaint was a lack of quality restaurant choices in a shopping center. And the third complaint was a lack of diversity in merchandise within the stores. All of those point to this issue. So it is critical. If no technological advances have happened, but had they not happened, this still would need to be changed, because it is one of the biggest problems confronting shopping centers today. What's going to happen, we believe, is this. The cost of energy, the cost of fuel, it's going to make it more difficult to offshore all of the production of products. It's going to make it more advantageous for local production to occur, and that's going to help quite a bit, the cost of energy. Another thing that's going to happen, we believe, as we talked about these RFID technologies, the ability to track products within stores and once they leave stores, it's going to diminish the need for security within the mall. We believe that in the future, store environments will be much less expensive to make. You won't need to wall them off as thoroughly as you need to do now. They'll feel more like trade shows will feel, where the product becomes the experience, and you can flow from one set of products to the next. The result of this will be that it's less expensive to build stores within shopping centers in the future. What that's going to do is very much what the internet has done, which is it's going to allow the kind of smaller retailer, the artisan, the person making one-off objects, to participate in the conventional retail setting and not only exist in the online world.
Plus, we're seeing a lot of success stories already. For example, the farmers market is a local, away from the monoculture that the mall is, and it's a very successful environment where people come and from the local crops or the local shops, they come and present their products. And I can see, for example, Larry, I see him on the farmer's market every Saturday, and he comes with the whole family and makes this a three-hour experience. I don't see many people doing that at the mall right now. So people tend to look for character, for local flavors. And also, if you think about food, this is strictly related to the farmer's market, but it's a seasonal thing. You tend to eat seasonal things, which is a much healthier way to eat.
I mean, imagine choosing which shopping center you go to as a result of the sort of craft and level of artistry of the people that live in that community. Imagine going from shopping center to discover what differentiators will occur in all of those into sort of farmer's market-like shop. You know, imagine it being a combination of a sort of high-tech farmer's market and trade show. The trade show environments are great because you have experts there. You have demonstrate, you know, you have the actual reality. You can try things out. You see things working in action. It's hands-on, but you can't buy anything there. So imagine hybridizing these two things and shopping centers feeling that way. And I think this is where things are going to head in the future.
Now, I want to point out that it's not necessarily that we're just going to go to a serious shift toward the local. It's going to be a mix of both things.
Of course,
currently,
of course.
Right now, the shopping center is a monoculture experience. So there's just going to be a mix of a little bit more of the local flavors.
One final question. What was the developer's response to your concept?
Well, I'll tell you, the developers are a diverse lot. I can tell you this. Given the numbers and the challenges that they're facing, developers are survivors. They are ingenious. These malls have responded over the 6 decades or so that the mall has existed. They've responded to multiple challenges, and that's largely because of the developers. They are interested in ideas right now. This is probably the most exciting time to be in our shoes. This is a time of change. Prior to this point, malls have been incredibly successful, incredibly efficient purveyors of goods and services. Well, now that's being challenged. The opportunities are very rich right now. Developers are asking these questions. The response that we've gotten to our future retail exercise and the sort of buzz that it's generated is because people are interested in answers to these very questions right now. So I think the future is incredibly bright. This is not about the death of anything. This is about rebirth and possibilities.
Thank you both for being our guest on Smart City.
Sure, thanks. Carol. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Carol.
Larry Weeks and Daniel Eisenman are senior designers with Communication Arts in Boulder, Colorado. We have a link to their graphic novel interpretation of Crossroads City on our website, smartcityradio.com. Finally, this week, Walker Smith comes not to bury the newspaper industry, but to praise it. Our City Views commentator offers this possibly premature eulogy for the newspaper industry.
This year and last have been a whirlwind of recessions, elections, and scandals. But there is one thing in particular that will be most remembered, and that is the end of the daily newspaper. I say this with a great deal of despondency because I am a daily newspaper junkie, and I believe that daily newspapers have played an essential role in shaping and sustaining American democracy. But we're going to have to figure out something else, because daily newspapers have been taken off life support. The latest figures from the Audit Bureau of Circulation show that newspaper circulation for the latest 6 months is down 7%. Zenith Optimedia estimates that ad spending for newspapers will be down 12% this year, including ad revenue declines of nearly 30% for the McClatchy Papers to 27% for the New York Times. The Pew Center has estimated that the newspaper industry lost 5,000 jobs last year. This year alone, 3 historic newspapers have ceased publication: the Rocky Mountain News, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which converted to a web-only publication, and the Christian Science Monitor, which also went web-only. The Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News now provide home delivery only on Thursdays, Fridays, and Sundays. The Washington Times quit publishing a Saturday edition. USA Today forced its staffers to take a week-long furlough in order to cut expenses. And the San Francisco Chronicle was only recently taken off its death watch by owners who had threatened to close it. Apparently, enough costs have been taken out to keep it going for now. The New York Times is in dire straits, having borrowed money against the value of its new building, negotiated a 5% pay cut with staffers, eliminated its quarterly dividend, reduced sections of the paper, and borrowed $250 million from a Mexican billionaire. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp has had to take a $3 billion write-down against the value of its newspaper unit, which includes the recently acquired Wall Street Journal, as well as Newsday. The Washington Post has had 3 rounds of employee buyouts and has dropped its weekend entertainment and lifestyle supplement, as well as its weekly book section. Warren Buffett, who is one of the largest investors in the company that owns the Washington Post, said at his recent investor conference that, quote unquote, for most newspapers in the U.S., we would not buy them at any price. This chronicle of woe could go on and on. Suffice it to say that daily newspapers will no longer be the preeminent source of journalism in America. We'll get our local updates from the new hyper-local news websites that are springing up. We'll depend on nonprofit organizations and think tanks for investigative reporting. We'll rely more and more on bloggers and Twitter and the social web for updates on things of interest to us. And we'll get our advertising from the internet and TV. Frankly, I worry about this. If you ever use Google News to find out about a story or a topic, what you are reminded of is that Google doesn't do any reporting. Google just aggregates all of the reporting that newspapers do. If you watch network news on TV each night, what you realize quickly is that most of those stories were reported first in the New York Times or the Washington Post. If you read blogs like the Huffington Post, you see that most of its reporting is about stories already broken by newspapers. So I'm not happy that soon there will be no newsprint staining my fingers every morning. But it's time to face up to it and to realize that if we want democracy to work as well in the future as it has in the past, we've got a big job ahead of us that we're going to have to undertake without the benefit of newspaper reporters watching over us to make sure that we get it right. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. There's lots more Smart City on our website, smartcityradio.com. You can read my blog, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to the podcast. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or by emailing us questions to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. I'm Carol Coletta.